inevitably you do meet saying that a person uncircumcised who kept the law, he never did anything that he couldn't have done, that he knew that he couldn't have done. Well, he said, you better take me out. Therefore, if the uncircumcision keeps the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be tried for circumcision? In other words, from that standpoint, God never commanded him to be marked anyhow. And if he's doing all these good things, doing the best he can, well, God says that. And shall not uncircumcision, which is by nature, in other words, the natural man, the way he's born, if it fulfill the law, shall it not judge thee who by the letter and circumcision that transgress the law? Now what he's working up to is this 28 and 29 verses now. For he is not a Jew, which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. Well now, there is such a thing as that. Yeah, I know there is. Well, why did you say it's not circumcision that's been out in the bed? Well, it don't amount to anything. Unless it's got this other with it. That's the point. But he is a Jew, which is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter. Whose praise is not of men, but of God. Incidentally, what spirit is he talking about? It's in the spirit. Thankfully, the translators in this testament have got a small letter there. And that's correct. That is not the Holy Spirit. Sure, the inward spirit. That's exactly what that's talking about. Let me give you some parallels here that I think will be interesting to you. Flip back to the first chapter of the Roman letter and look at verse 9. That would just be a fallacy of any fairness at all. He's not saying, I never did do what I know I ought to do. No, no. He's just saying that there are times when I find myself doing something, and then I say to myself, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Never. I call it kicking myself. Put my face, put my mouth. you know, well, all right, that's what he said. He said, I know better, but that takes time. Now he said, for the good that I would, it is his will, this what I want, this is my spirit, the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do. Now if I do what I would not, he says, it's no more I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. And I will discuss that when we get to it again. I found in a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. Well, I think even enough of this to point out that Paul says there's a conflict in my spirit and what I do. Now, that causes him to say in the 24th verse, he says, oh, wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? Now think of the context of this. Paul is talking about law. He's been contrasting law and faith. He's been contrasting a person looking to law for his justification and looking to Jesus Christ for his justification. Now, he says, if under law, this is the point, if I'm under law and that's all I've got, then even though my will is right, I want to be right, but I fail. So I'm done. Oh, wretched man that I am. Who shall deliver me from the body of this death? How can I get out of this? I want to be better. I know what I ought to do, but sometimes I find myself failing. How can I get out of that? I'm stuck. Now, the answer is in the next verse. I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. There's the answer. Who shall deliver me from the body of this death? Jesus Christ our Lord shall deliver me from the body of this death. So then, now watch it. So then, with the mind, I'm going to put that right under here. With the mind, I serve the law of God. With the mind, I serve the law of God, and this understood is through Jesus Christ. They understood, he's already there. He's already saved it in the previous verse. Well, and I cannot know. See, we've got a parallel here. In Romans 1:9, he says, I serve God with my spirit in the gospel. In Romans 7:25, he says, I serve the law of God with the mind through Jesus Christ. Isn't that a parallel? Didn't that do you something? Make a good point. Now, with that kind of a parallel in front of you, look at back where we were in Romans 2. Romans 2:28-29. He says, for he is not a Jew if he went out to Jew. Now there's the external only, you see. But neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. There's the external only. He's already told you there's nothing wrong with circumcision. God commanded you. But if that's all you've got, you don't have anything.
Well,
you can march it up to anything like that. That's fine. If that's all you've got, if you've just got the external, well, you said, I sat there in the pew on Sunday. Well, so what? You sat there in the pew. Are you telling me, therefore you do not have to worship God? Don't come on Sunday. Just quit coming on Sunday. Oh, no, that's not what you're saying. But you say it's just being there is all there is to it. I don't know anything. If it's the external, you're not saying that there is no importance in the external. You couldn't draw the conclusion from this that therefore man does never have to take the Lord's Supper. So that's all that's just eating bread and taking the food about. Well, it is easy for him to take the food around. But there's more to it if it's done the way it ought to be done. See what he's saying? There's a lot more to it. Now, he says he is a Jew, which is one inwardly. There's other things got to be with it. who is a Jew, which is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart. Well, it's in the flesh also, isn't it? Yes, it's in the flesh, but unless the heart went with it, you see no form to it. The circumcision is that of the heart. Then you see, incidentally, how can a heart be circumcised? Certainly not literally. Cut away the lust. Cut away the lust. Cut away the desire to get even with somebody. That's circumcised in the heart. Cut away anything that's impure. That's right. That's the idea. You cut that away. All right. Now, circumcision is that of the heart. In the spirit. We're not talking about the blood transport. In the spirit. Not in the letter. He prays he's not a man but a God. Not in the letter. Not important to do anything about this. That's not the point at all. That's a complete perversion of what he says. He's not saying that you don't have to do what it says for you to do. He is saying that unless the heart is with it, the brain doesn't amount to anything. I don't know why that's so hard for anybody to understand, but time and time again, you try to make a lesson on that, and somebody goes out and says, well, so I think just so you have the right attitude, you make sure you did it or not. That's not what that's saying. That's not what I'm saying. But if you're saying the same, this has got to be right. It's saying that. And this has got to be done with this sort of qualification. See, the qualification goes with this must qualify. You can't serve God with your spirit alone. It's in the mind. You can't serve the law of God with the mind alone. It's through Jesus Christ. See how the thing has to look to me? I think that's a powerful lesson. So then we come to the third chapter. The third chapter. He says, what advantage then hath a Jew? You've got to note that Paul, one of the questions between the introductory material that you have, and I haven't gone into that because I say you wouldn't have time. You're going to have to do that for yourself. But one of the questions there is, what kind of people was it in Rome to whom Paul wrote this letter? Well, were the Jews or Gentiles? I think you'll find when you've done your homework well that predominantly it was a Gentile church, but it had Jews in it. It's got both of them. And we'll find later on when we get to the 11th chapter that Paul says, verse 13, for I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I'm an apostle of the Gentiles, for I speak to you Gentiles. I think that predominantly it was a Gentile church in the 16th chapter where he's listing all the people from the Greeks and some Greeks to do. I think there are two Jewish names in that bunch, and the rest of them are evenly divided between Roman names and Greek names. And that's in the 16th chapter. I haven't talked about those things because I don't have time to go into all that. 16th chapter?
54
names. I don't know. I mean, what was that
talking about? The Gentile United.
Oh, yes. 11th chapter. 11th chapter and 13th verse. Romans 11, 13. For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles. He just saying over there, I wanted to run off on the Jews. But I'm talking to Gentiles, I wanted to run off on the Jews. So the third chapter, back where we are, he recognizes the presence of the Jew, and then I think there's another thing comes into this. When you study when the Roman letter was written, it was written probably the last of the letters that Paul wrote before the prison letters. It was written early in the spring of 58. As he was on his way back to Jerusalem, bringing the arms to the Jewish people there, and that's where they falsely accused him, and the Roman soldiers took him away from the mob, you see, and they led him finally back to the prison, or led him to prison in Rome. So about 58, in the spring of 58, I think you'll find, when you dig into your introductory material. He recognizes the fact that there is going to be a Jew Gentile problem in the church. But that's a nice thing.
That's obvious.
Yeah, that's very obvious.
That's right.
So as he speaks to the Gentiles and teaches them these principles about the gospel of Christ, he has to keep praising against Judaism. You see, whether it's predominantly Jewish or not, and I don't think it is. It's not impossible though to see, in fact it's very obvious to see, that he had to keep praising against Judaism.
Like you could, in the context of our situation, you're saying that this doesn't mean Pentecostalism.
Right.
Now that's what we're going to have to look at, that it's angry because it's not their own.
That's right. And we just have to keep it balanced. But that's right. You must do it. Well, that's what I'm doing when I talk about spirit, because there's so much talk now about this spirit only thing. You got to keep the context of your present situation in mind, in order to make the lessons valid and to make them applicable to the people that confront us. You just got to do that. All right, so he raises this question. What advantage do they have to do? Or what profit is there of circumcision? You might think he's going to say none. But no, he says, no, in every way. He says, there's a lot of advantages. You see, because that under them were committed the oracles of God. But what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? Now there's a whole string of arguments that I'm going to steal. We could really get bedded down in his argument from the third verse through the eighth. The third through the eighth. I'm just going to have to leave you to dig them out for you there. But they are arguments made by Paul's reason. They're sort of philosophical in a way, and I don't mean that in a bad sense. I mean that he's reasoning with the people about that. Well, would you say this? Well, no, you can't say that. I'm going to have to skip that. What then? Verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? No. He says in no way. For we have before proved, both Jews and Gentiles, that they're all under sin. So that's exactly what he's saying. All in the same boat. The whole point of the first chapter, second chapter, and a big part of the third chapter is to say, we're all in the same boat. That's exactly what he's saying. We're all in the same boat. We're under sin. We stand condemned before God, and that's justice. Now, that leads him look back into the past and says, actually had a string in it. That's the thing that happened. So he says, here we are up here, what are we doing? Christianity, what's going on, Jimmy? Remember what he said? All have sinned and do now come short. That's the point. Now, I'm not a Greek grammarian, and please don't understand me to be trying to play like I know all that about Greek. I just simply look it up, that's all. I just know what I read in the papers. But in the book, it'll tell you, and it makes some wonderful points if you take the time to dig it out. That's one of the things I like about that kind of study. And it certainly makes a fine point there, doesn't it? All have sinned and doesn't come short of the glory of God, being justified freely by His grace through the redemption given in Christ Jesus. And we've already studied this. Is there any question about these points along here? Oh, I know there's a lot of things can come up, but the general point, have we got the point now on what Paul is saying? First proposition, you're sinners, and justice and mercy. Second proposition, law is not the answer. Third proposition, it's by grace, through what God has done for us, and our acceptance of that grace. Faith. That's what he said. All right, but now that brings up this big question. Well, that brings up this whopping big question. What about this faith? Now, see, we've just been passing lightly over that. I haven't been dealing with it because I knew that we were going to come to the fourth chapter. And in the fourth chapter, Paul decides to give us a real good example of faith so that we can know what he's talking about. Now, I think this is just absolutely marvelous, the way it's arranged. That he doesn't try to explain faith and that it has to be an obedient faith. Now, he doesn't deal with all that. But when he gets ready to really explain what he's talking about, he comes to the fourth chapter and he uses Abraham as an example and just stretches it out in front of him. I don't know how a person could miss it. Fourth chapter. Oh, incidentally, before we get to fourth, the closing part of the third chapter is a real nice place to watch. Verse 28. Therefore we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of law. Therefore we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of law. Is he the God of the Jew only? Is God the God of Jews only? Is he not also the Gentile? Is he yet of the Gentiles also? Seeing it is one God, which will justify the circumcision, that's you, by faith, and the uncircumcision through faith. And I don't know what the difference is in buying through, but one of them is deal and one of them is in. One of them is seen in, and one of them is deal.
From what I've read, that there is really no real difference between the two, but they never really understood exactly why they were there.
I don't understand just why they get screwed today, but they're not. And so I can't say much about that. But what I wanted to call your attention to was the last verse. Do we then make void the law through faith?
The law. Yes, I just want to check that to be sure. It is law. Yeah.
That's right. Do we then make void the law through faith? In other words, that's correct. Are we just saying that because it's by faith, it's the law that doesn't have any place? And he answers, and it's so clear, God forbid. And of course, Paul didn't say that. Do you understand that sometimes an expression like that is the translator's expression? Be it not so, or something like that in the literal translation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, may it not be. He says, God forbid. Yea, we establish God. And this is a real fine point, I think. He says, why, instead of what I'm saying, erasing the importance of the authority of God and the commandments of God and the necessity for obedience, instead of it erasing that, he says it establishes it.
Okay, now this last point in verse 31 is the article there, we establish the law.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
law.
the established law.
I wonder why the New York Times says that you didn't put the footnote on that.
Not that. I fixed it in all the different. I've got Tom Street Check, Nestle Street Check, Westcott and Horace Street Check. Well, I don't know why. I don't know why there is no more attention given to the auditor. Now, I do know this, and Robinson Street Grammar and David Street Grammar and all of these point this out. If you read, it takes a lot of searching around there to find it. But they all say that there is some, that it's not real good. Definite, clear, exactly just when you can insert the article in order to finish out a sentence and when you could. It's a little hard. It's one of those problems in translating from a language to another language that's a little hazy at point. And they all say the context must determine it, and of course you're all familiar with that. And I gave you three examples where the context very clearly determines. Yeah, I think those examples I gave you just really make it clear. But that only makes it clear in those places. You can't draw the conclusion that therefore everywhere you've got the absence of an article, you have to mark it out and make it mean something else. You can't do that. And I guess that's why the translators followed suit with the King James or something like that. See, the Bishop Bible and well, forget that one. He was Trigella. That doesn't sound right. Whoever, yeah, Trigella. He made a translation into German and then, yeah, and into English. These early translators, before the King James translated 1611. If there were any translations before the King James, the Bible had already been translated into English. And there was conflict in England over the translation because at that time they were discussing a lot of reform movements, and it was a big problem because they got the translations and so on. And that's why King James, about the insistence of the Pilgrim government, at the insistence of the Quakers, the Quaker segment. And the influence that they had in his cabinet and all caused King James to say, well, all right, we'll have a translation made by a group of scholars instead of one scholar. We'll have, 48, wasn't it? 47 or 48 scholars. We'll have these scholars all come together and they'll give us an official translation. And that's what that means, received. People, you know, the King James is called the received text. And this goes back to a text, the Textus Receptus, which had been made some years before. And now, an authorized version, authorized by King James. That doesn't mean authorized by God. That's authorized by King James.
Yeah, well, God's got to do it
today. I know it. Well, mind you, I favor the King James myself. I use it all the time. But still, I got to recognize the fact for a case. I can't just ignore the fact.
Let me bring out a question here that I'd like to have some clarification on. We have people, even in the Lord's Church, that are advocating the idea of us not being under law, period. That we're not under any kind of the law.
Yeah.
All right? Comment on that.
I do. It's in the plain talk for this next month. That was my question.
Okay.
I had a question. No, I think that's just plain not so. That's just not recognizing. This statement here, may we establish law, seems to me to be a very good starting point. And then in his definition of faith here, he does the same thing. In his discussion of Abraham, fourth chapter, he does the same thing.
Even the very definition of what sin is being a transgression. There is no law.
No law, no sin. No, that just won't work. But I got that question. In fact, I got it. Because that question is going to be in the plain talk of this month, in the question and answer section. I think that it is simply one of those things kind of like, as I believe Paul is driving at right here, he has been pointing out that we're not justified by law, but we're justified by faith. And then he says, does this mean that we have erased law? I mean, this is the very thing that brings that up. Verse 31. Do we then make void law through faith? He says, no.
Okay, so we say this way then, we recognize the existence of law. So we recognize that we're being subjected to law, but at the same time recognizing we're not being justified by
that. That's the point that I make in the article is that if you will keep in mind that what is negated is justification by law. He's not negating law, he's negating justification by law. And it all goes back to the chart, and I've gone so many times, I can do it in a few. Goes back to that chart. To be justified by law, you have to measure up perfectly. That's the only way, because justified means free of guilt. To have no guilt on the basis of law, you must never sin. But all is done. Come, shall we go about? Therefore, there is no justification by law.